Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Welcome to the best of Connecting Faith. This previously aired program highlights some of our most compelling conversations at noon on Faith Radio.
Hey, I'm excited to talk to today's guest, who is an expert. Of course, because he doesn't live in the Midwest, so he's at least 50 miles from home. and as I understand, he's starting to get a little bit of a gray in his hair. So we're or maybe it's his beard anyway. But we are. I've been looking forward to talking to Larry Osborne for some time. I've seen his name, authored a number of books, things like Sticky Teams, Accidental Pharisees, 10 Dumb Things Smart Christians Believe, Spirituality for the Rest of Us, The Unity Factor. The one that we're going to talk about is his latest. It's called Innovation's Dirty Little Secret, Why Serial Innovators Succeed Where Others Fail. But Larry is, among other things, husband, father, and pastor, and author. Leadership consultant. Since 1980, he served as one of the senior pastors at North Coast Church in Vista, California. And during that time, North Coast has grown from a small group of 100 plus or so meeting in a rented high school cafeteria to a multi-site church ministering to 10,000 plus in the weekend attendance. And Larry is now teaching pastor at North Coast Church in northern San Diego County, and we are happy to welcome him to Connecting Faith. Larry, thanks so much for carving out a little time today.
Oh, I'm very glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I do want to talk a little bit about this this wonderful topic of innovation. It's a fascinating book, and I would recommend it. It's called Innovation's Dirty Little Secret. But I guess maybe I want to start with, should we be innovating? Is it change for change's sake? Is that reason enough to try our hand at innovation?
Well, actually, one of the points I try to bring out is change for change's sake is pretty much a waste of time. It just gives everybody organizational whiplash. What you want to do is you want to change the right things for the right reasons. But if we don't do that, we end up paying a horrible, horrible price because What happens is we get stuck with doing yesterday's ministry methods, and the fact is our message never changes, but the methods sure do over time.
Because the subtitle is about the serial innovators. Were you kind of a tinkerer? Is that sort of your style, your nature? So you're always sort of, I guess maybe we should talk about the difference between someone who tinkers and an innovator.
Yeah, the difference is an innovator looks at the way things are done often and says, well, is this really the best way or why are we doing that? So there's almost a little bit of a contrarian mindset that goes with that stands on the side and says, doggone it, everybody says that's a nice outfit, but I don't think that emperor has any clothes on him. And so at the end of the day, innovators tend to be much more about fixing things that aren't working rather than just trying things to see what in the world would happen.
You've had plenty of opportunity to do that over the years. I mean, did you sort of fall into it and out of that develop some patterns? I mean, the book is just well researched and lots of illustrations, but talk a little bit about your journey and innovation.
Well, one of the things with serial innovators is I don't think everybody can become one. They can learn how to recognize it and how to support innovation. But part of it is serial innovators, as I researched them, as I kind of looked back over my own life, I realized that they think a little bit differently. They see life a little bit differently. And they often assume, well, everybody sees the same thing that I see. And that's just not really true. It's like a musician thinking that everybody should hear those notes the way they hear those notes. And so for an organization, it's more allowing these people the freedom to try some of the things they want to try than every one of us finding a way to become innovative. I can't tune a piano no matter how much training I get. It's just not going to happen.
Well, Well, so are innovators like artists in that? I mean, you know, sometimes you ask an artist, well, how'd you do that? And they say, well, I don't know. I just, you know, kind of threw it up on the wall and it stuck kind of thing. But, you know, so is there a difference between sort of the artistic innovator and the organizational innovator?
Well, yeah, there is, in the sense that innovators are like in a lot of different fields. There's people who, I call them conscious competence and unconscious competence. A conscious competent understands why they do what they do, and the unconscious person just does it naturally. Think of, we just finished a World Series. Think of the star hitter who understands how he hits, and then every now and then there's others who just say, well, watch the ball, pick up the seams, and hit it. It's like, I can't do that. And then there's others who become great hitting coaches and are able to help other people. So there's just like in the music industry, in your field, and in virtually every field, there's people who just intuitively do it. And there's other people who understand what they're doing. And that's a bit of a personality makeup.
Well, my guest today is Larry Osborne, and we're talking about innovation. In fact, the title of his new book is called Innovation's Dirty Little Secret, Why Serial Innovators Succeed Where Others Fail. And we want to make sure we reveal those secrets today. By the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, or just to, if you've had some experience trying to present some changes and new ideas that went poorly, maybe there's some insights you can gain from today's discussion. Or if you have a question for Larry, we'd love to have you join the broadcast at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. You can always go online as well. At myfaithradio.com, go to our website, myfaithradio.com, and you can click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email link there. Or if it's more convenient, it's Facebook. It's Connecting Faith with Neil Stavem, and you can connect all those ways with us and hope that you will. Larry, I want to jump in. One of the principles that you talk about early on is that exit strategy is pretty important. Let's unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, well, the dirty little secret about innovation is that most innovations fail. You go to conferences, you read books, and you only hear the stories of the great successes. But whether it's a church plant, it's a new business, it's a new idea, the majority of them actually fail. And so one thing serial innovators do that a lot of people don't realize you need to do is they put as much effort into thinking through how they're going to bail out of this great idea if it's not so great as they do in their implementation strategy. So my little byline is that an exit strategy is just as important as an implementation strategy. But sometimes, especially in Christian circles, we'll almost feel like an exit strategy is a lack of faith. So we won't even want to go there or talk about what we're going to do if this thing doesn't work. But the fact is, most new things don't work all that well, or at least need some significant mid-course corrections along the way.
And you talk about using words like experiment or trial run. That kind of goes along with that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. See, when I at North Coast throughout the years, people think of our church, we have this reputation of being innovative and having started a lot of things spread across the country. And so people think, wow, they're very innovative and don't fail much. And the truth of the matter is we fail all the time. But we always try things. We say we're going to do a little experiment here. We're going to see if this works. We're going to do it for 6 weeks. All kinds of terminology like that. And when that fails, people look at you and go, whoa, you were just trying, so you're not a failure. In science, when you do experiments, half your victory is finding out what won't work so that you can find what works. But let's say I've got everybody on board with a sermon series, why this is the most important thing ever, or written position papers. Boy, once I oversell on the front end, I'm dead meat if it doesn't work. I've just lost all my credibility.
So what happens at the end of the 6 weeks? You just sort of slink back and never bring up the topic again? Or
one of my big points is that we tend to oversell on the front end. It's counterintuitive to undersell, but so we oversell. And we think we're getting everybody to buy in and getting setting it up for the best opportunity to succeed. But the more we oversell, the more we can't make changes if needed or bail out. But let me give you a real example. A thing called sermon-based small groups, kind of a lecture lab model, has now spread to thousands and thousands of churches across the country. And we started that, 1985, I think it was, or something, that we began to do that. And all I did was a little six-week series. Think of Rick Warren's purpose-driven life type of thing or something. I think I called it the marks of a mature Christian or something like that. And I said, all of our small groups are going to study it together. We hoped it'd be the new way we did things, take the sermon, dig deeper into the topic. At the end of the 6 weeks, everybody liked it, so we just kept doing it. Now it's 2013, and we're still doing it, and thousands of churches are. But I had an incredibly easy exit strategy if it had bombed after that short little series. I go, oh, we're going back to our old way of doing small groups.
The cover your tail, I think it sounds a lot like that. But
Well, yeah, because it was a great idea, but you don't know whether a great idea is really great until it's released into the wild, because some things aren't adopted. Think of a keyboard we all use. It was originally designed to slow you down in the day and age of mechanical keyboards, because very fast typists would jam the keys. And there are other layouts of a keyboard that are much faster. They don't force you to predominantly use your left hand, which our keyboard does. They don't use your weaker fingers for some of the major letters. But even though a faster one has been made, nobody's bought it. We're good enough with what we are, instead of the Dvorak and some of the other ones out there. And that's how some ministry innovations fail. It is a great idea, but people don't feel the need for it or want it. And then suddenly you're standing there with a warehouse full of this new keyboard nobody wants, or staff and all kinds of energy in a new ministry program nobody wants. So you've always got to have some way to get out of it if the real world doesn't respond like it did on paper or in a meeting.
So we're going to talk in a moment more about how do we get to that point where people maybe realize the need for it. They don't always know until it's there. And you know, so we can keep those great ideas coming and innovation going. And we're getting a great perspective today from Larry Osborne. He's teaching pastor at North Coast Church in northern San Diego County and one of the most influential and innovative churches in America, North Coast is. And Larry's been leading them since 1980 and done all sorts of wonderful, amazing things. Written a number of books. The one we're referencing today, his latest, is called Innovation's Dirty Little Secret: Why Serial Innovators Succeed Where Others Fail. It's new from Zondervan, and we're going to talk more with Larry in a moment. And you'd like to join the conversation, we welcome you to ask a question or maybe share an innovation thought that you might have had with Larry. You can call us at 877-933-2484.
Stay tuned. More of the best of Connecting Faith in just moments.
Ready to get back on track with your resolutions and goals? We want to help as you commit to live fit.
Hey friends, this is Susie Larson, and I'm excited to announce the launch of our 40-day challenge, Commit to Live Fit. Each week, we deliver an email to your inbox with tips and encouragement to help build a stronger you, both physically and spiritually, as we head into the Easter season. It's not too late to sign up and join our six-week journey of faith and fitness. Head over to myfaithradio.com to sign up today.
Faith Radio's mission is to lead people to Christ and nurture you in your spiritual growth through Christ-centered media. We recently connected online with David from Bangladesh.
I'm so glad to have been introduced to MyFaithRadio.com. I like to listen to Faith Radio, which I get through this address online. It's my wish that God will expand His ministry everywhere in the world.
MyFaithRadio.com crosses borders and even oceans. Log on today at MyFaithRadio.com and join the conversation helping to spread the message of Faith Radio.
Back now to the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired encore presentation.
Looking forward to continuing our conversation today with Larry Osborne. Larry's a husband, a father, pastor, author, and leadership consultant. He's teaching pastor at North Coast Church in northern San Diego. And he's written a number of books, including Sticky Teams, Sticky Church, Accidental Pharisees, 10 Dumb Things Smart Christians Believe, Spirituality for the Rest of Us, The Unity Factor, the one we're referencing today, Innovation's Dirty Little Secret. And they were excited about opportunities to understand a little bit more. I was wondering, Larry, maybe we just to kind of reset, Is every invention an innovation, or are there some hallmarks of how do we know that it actually is an innovation?
Yeah, I think to call something a genuine innovation, it not only has to solve a problem, it's got to be widely adopted. I always tell people the better mousetrap that nobody buys is a great invention, but it's not an innovation because it's just sitting there somewhere. So at the end of the day, when it comes to, let's say, a ministry setting, or I do some consulting with businesses, we always have to ask, is this being adopted? Because if not, we're spending an awful lot of time, money, and energy on something that is theoretically a great idea, but for whatever reasons, the marketplace isn't ready for it, and it's not making the difference that we hoped it would.
We just sort of talked a little bit earlier about, you know, people not feeling the need for it. I mean, that's always, I guess, the challenge, isn't it? So does it become about marketing? Is, you know, until FedEx came around, right, no one knew they needed overnight delivery here.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There are all kinds of stories in business circles. Survey and marketing groups were shown the fax machine. They were shown microwave ovens. They were shown minivans. And everybody said, well, I don't like that idea. I don't want one of those, until they suddenly showed up, and then they had to have it. And so that's once more one of the reasons why you never know when it comes to innovation how people are going to respond. But if it doesn't change the way people act and it doesn't really work, then, well, it's nothing but a great idea.
So is there, I mean, you're not necessarily a fan of innovation by committee, but I know you talk a little bit about research and applying data. Do you, is research valuable?
Well, there's a big difference between research and collaboration, and they get mixed up. And in today's politically correct world of leadership, everybody's for collaboration, which means everybody gets some input, and at the end of the day, whatever you come out with has everybody's fingerprints on it. But if you were to turn that around and say, no, we want all of that counsel and advice and information, but it's not collaboration where everybody gets to have their little piece of the pie or their piece thrown into it, it's research. Then that changes everything. We do lots of research around North Coast, but it's, again, a small circle of one to three usually that come up with the best ideas. And so at that point, they kind of weigh the different opinions, because you know all opinions aren't equal. You want to weigh opinions. That's one reason anonymous opinions aren't very valuable. You don't know if this is a chronic complainer, Pollyanna that's always happy, bright person, more dull, whatever it would be. So at the end of the day, we love research. There's wisdom in the council of many, but that is different than collaboration, which is we all put our little piece together and you end up with something crazy.
So is there value in doing surveys, or is it just making sure we're sort of surveying the right people?
I think, frankly, most surveys are not very helpful, especially in church settings, because of two reasons. One is if they're anonymous, you can't weigh them. And the second thing is when people put their names on them, they're not honest. You take a survey in any church and start asking people how many tithe, and you're going to get a lot higher percent if their names are on it of what they claim they give, as opposed to what all research shows the average is about 2%. That's not a tithe, that's a tooth. And it's the same with exercise, same with diet. People over-report on the positive side. So at the end of the day, they can have some value, but they are usually way overvalued.
And again, the weighing the response, that's an important principle no matter what field we might be in.
Absolutely. For instance, we have a rule at North Coast Church that anything anonymous is never even read, because all it does is confuse us and we get in brain debates. So if somebody wrote on a worship response card, which at our church is done at the end of the service, that it was too hot or too cold, if we don't have a name, we can't contact him to find out, well, where were you sitting? Is this somebody who tends to always run hot or cold, just physically? So it's not very helpful if I can't weigh it.
Talking with Larry Osborne, you want to join the conversation, talking about innovation today. Innovation's Dirty Little Secret is the title of his book. It's from Zondervan. And Larry is pastor of North Coast Church in Southern California, joining us today. And we're talking about ways in which we can see innovation take place. One of the things you talk, we talk about wisdom of many counselors. You suggest advisors or talk about outside advisors. Maybe clarify the difference between sort of the internal and the external advisor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, anybody who's got any leadership skill set at all can solve a lot of problems just themselves, thinking about it, praying about it, mulling on it. Then we kind of move next to my team, which are those closest to me. And then I call it my tribe, the people that we naturally associate with. A church might be a denomination or group of like-minded churches. But all of our biggest problems, when they get huge, are almost always solved by outsiders because they see the world differently than we do, and they don't see the limitations. And they just go and do things. We go, you can do that? I didn't know you could do that. And so I'm a big fan of finding advisors that are outside of our natural circles. Got some just fun little stories of that. One quick one is General Mills knew everything every other company was doing in terms of factory turnover from one flake to another flake. And they were spending 4.5 hours in the turnover. But they were also sponsoring a NASCAR team. So their CEO took down their top engineers to spend a week with guys who do in 7 seconds what should take 15 minutes. And they came back and they now turn around the same factory that used to take 4.5 hours in 13 minutes. And it was because they got outside of all the engineers who knew manufacturing and found somebody who knew nothing about their field but knew everything about doing stuff fast. And the same thing can happen in ministry and business settings. Get outside of yourself, outside of your field, and they have answers to things we'd never have thought about.
Which is just would be challenging, I guess, to try and think about, well, what field would I want to pursue? I mean, do I want to get the NASCAR pit crew? You'd have to really determine what the problem was you're trying to solve, I guess, first, right?
Yeah. But it's more sometimes we limit because we all have natural ones. One I like to show, sometimes people think that only a Christian can teach us something on organization, for instance. But at the end of the day, when my plumbing is broken, I don't care whether the guy's got a fish on his truck. I just want to know he knows how to fix the pipes. I'm not going to turn to a non-Christian for moral values or help me understand scripture. But there are many things, and there's frankly a lot of churches and Christians that, well, if it doesn't come with a fish on it, we don't want anything to do with it. And I always point them to Jethro. Telling Moses how to organize the children of Israel. The guy was a pagan. Well, the night before he acknowledged God, so he has one night's sleep of knowing God, and then he's standing up and he's telling Moses, you're going to burn out if you don't make all of these changes. Who would have guessed that a pagan mindset would have the key to keep Moses from burning out? Yeah,
there might be a sermon there. I don't know. But probably only for 6 weeks, and they could just be an experiment, I suppose, right?
Yes, that's right.
Maybe talk a little bit more about sort of the corporate culture that, I mean, we even though churches obviously isn't in a corporation, but we still sometimes think alike, I guess, like a corporation, don't we?
Well, yeah, because organization is organization, the people sometimes go that churches do business-like, and I totally agree if they're talking about business values. But a wise business with 50 people working together has to come up with communication structures and structures to keep the organization legal and how do you decide things, all kinds of things like that. And a church is no different. Once you get to a certain size, bigger than a house church, you have to organize. And so at that point, there are principles that we can learn. Absolutely, from all kinds of settings.
Do these principles work if you're a pastor of a church of 30 or 50 or 70 compared to a church of 1,000 or 5,000?
I think most organizational principles begin to become much more important somewhere around 150. Frankly, when I first came and there were 70 adults, a little over 100 at North Coast Church, that's like a really big family, extended family certainly, but. At that point, it's almost 100% relational, but all you got to do is get to 150 or 200 people, and you think you're very relational, but you're really a relational core with a bunch of people circling around on the outside trying to figure out how they connect. And so at that point, you've got to organize. How do we know who's here? What's happening? How do we really know they're being taken care of? And How do we know somebody's actually going to be in the nursery when that family shows up with a little kid? So, bingo. Suddenly we're having the same organizational problems that any organization does, whether it's for-profit, non-profit, business, or Christian.
We're talking innovation today with Larry Osborne, teaching pastor at North Coast Church in northern San Diego County. Larry's written Innovation's Dirty Little Secret, Why Serial Innovators Succeed Where Others Fail. And there's much more to come in the conversation. Stay tuned to Connecting.
Back now to the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired encore presentation.
We're talking about innovation today here in Connecting Faith. As Larry Osborne has told us already, that when it comes to most new ventures, failure is most often the case. And so we're finding out some ways that we can prepare for that and maybe work around that and see change take place, breaking through some ceilings and all those things. With Larry Osborne today, teaching pastor at North Coast Church, northern San Diego County. It's a significant church, some 10,000 plus coming to the weekends. And Larry has been innovating for many years there, and others come from all across the country and around the world to see how they do church. Innovation's Dirty Little Secret is his book. And Larry, let's got Dan calling in on line one. We'll just take a call right away before we keep on our discussion. Dan, you're on with Larry Osborne. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. And this is a timely discussion. As in the organization that I'm working for, we've been talking about futuring and disruptive thinking for our products. However, Larry, in your opinion, what is the biggest barrier to innovation happening in an organization? What stops this from being something that is that moves forward?
Sure. Well, there's not just one. There are numerous kind of standard ones, and one is too much research, because when it comes to a true innovation, there is no proof that it will work. And sometimes organizations are too risk adverse. They're so afraid of failure, they keep saying, "Well, prove to me it'll work. Prove to me it'll work." Well, you can't prove. I think back to at North Coast Church when we started a thing called Video Venues that eventually morphed into multi-site churches using video. Even my own staff was 9 to 2 that, "Oh, that's a crazy idea. It sounds like an overflow room, and that's a punishment for being late. Why would anybody want to come to that?" And bottom line, I just had to say, you know what, let's try something over here. And after they saw it a week or two, they all went, "Oh, now I get it," because they'd never seen it before. So a bias or a fear of failure is one of the biggest things, because organizations think they have to be all in. And if we're all in and all the chips have been put on the table, so here we go with this, of course they're afraid. And so they want more research. So out of all of the many, I would think an overanalysis and seeking too much certainty that something will succeed is the biggest innovation killer that's out there.
So is it better than to just do, to do small, make it really incremental as opposed to doing big change? Because incremental isn't necessarily innovation then, is it?
Well, incremental is if it's getting to somewhere that actually changes things.
Okay.
Let me give you an example from Coca-Cola, a disaster and a success. When they came out with New Coke, based on some research groups that they pretty much showed that people, for a first few taste like the a sweeter taste, which, by the way, they didn't like when they were drinking a whole can of it. So what happened was, based on this little bit of research, they came out with New Coke and abandoned Old Coke and had quite a disaster on their hands. Much smarter would have been to have just another style, as they have done with Coke Zero and Diet Coke. They didn't replace one with the other. They just put them both out there, and then they stand back and see, well, which one's going to take over? It's always best to innovate with on the fringe, I call it, a little bit of both and. Again, one of the things that kills it is people see it as either or instead of both and. And so they go, "Well, we've got to go with the old. We can't hurt that, or we got to go all in with the new."
And hence, as you talk about having the exit strategy or using words like trial run or experiment or so.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that just opens the door. Hugely. Hardly anybody will stop you from experimenting. But we know all kinds of groups, and Christians aren't unique for it. It's in the business world as well. people are afraid of change. In fact, all kinds of studies have shown over 50% of people, when it comes to adopting change and innovation, won't even be for it until it's successful and they know who else is for it. So by definition, you can't on the front end ever get beyond 50% approval.
Which brings the topic of the importance of a champion, a respected champion. Talk about why that's such a key part of this.
Well, in almost every group, small or large, there are certain people, when they speak up, everybody listens. And when they're, I always ask leaders if I'm consulting with them in the Christian world or even the business world, I say, who on your team or who in your organization, if they say, oh, this is a horrible idea, you know in your gut that it's going to go nowhere. I say, identify them. And also, who if they're a champion, everybody's going to say, well, I don't know, but they're for it. Let's give it a try. And then I say, well, let's get those people aboard. Let's not try to sell everybody. Let's go and see what it takes to get those people aboard to at least allowing us to try it. And I found whenever you have a respected champion, you can try anything because everybody go, well, they're for it. Because people don't really understand new ideas. They always interpret them in light of what they've already experienced. As I said, a video cafe, video venue rather, worship was an overflow room. Early fax machines were, well, why in the world would I want a note that I can hardly read on shiny paper? So they don't see where it's going to go. They compare it to what they've already seen.
So is it always the same person, that champion? I mean, so you have kind of your, not necessarily, or I mean, it's your board, you know, your board chairman or someone who's just outspoken?
Yeah, in the real world, it tends to ebb and flow, but most organizations have a few people. I mean, candidly, on our board, there's one or two people that if they're, and it's not always a person in the position of, say, chairman or whatever, it's the personal power that they have. And there's one or two people that if they're against an idea, I know ahead of time it's going to go nowhere. That's just the credibility that they have. So it's not that they're manipulative or some bad kind of roadblock. It's that they have a lot of credibility. And so if they have all that credibility, why would I not seek out their wisdom and their input to either get their approval to do it or make get them aboard as a fan or at the very least say, yeah, I'll step aside and let you try it.
You're going to expend a lot of energy trying to work against that otherwise, aren't you?
Absolutely. And you can have, I learned this as a young youth pastor. I didn't know the guy before me had been fired for spending all of his time with this little, he called it a band of men, 12 guys, not even girls involved, that he poured his life into in a large church and the rest of the youth group brought it. So I came up with a discipleship program, leadership training, and it just got blown out of the water by the deacon board at this church because they heard it in light of the guy who'd been fired before me. So I talked to a respected champion, as I call them, and found out the history behind it and changed it to VOOMT, stupidest name ever, stood for Vocational Ministry Training Program. And a month later, I not only got approval, I got double the budget I asked for. And it was only because I had a respected champion who helped me figure out how to word it, and bingo, everybody was for it.
You talk in the book, Innovation's Dirty Little Secret. By the way, Larry Osborne, my guest today, is author of the book, Innovation's Dirty Little Secret. He's written a number of others as well, recommended reading. He's a pastor and a leadership consultant. He pastors at North Coast Church in Southern California. It's a large and very influential church in our nation. You can join the conversation as we talk innovation at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. In the book, you talk about maybe sometimes we hit a wall that up and to the right, you know, continual growth isn't necessarily the pattern that represents reality. Somehow we've decided that that has to be it.
Right. Yeah, there's a myth out there that is widely bought, and that is and causes a lot of people in different ministry settings to feel really defeated and guilty. And the myth is that living things grow and multiply, and it's always perpetuated by people on the stage who have really big ministries that are still going up and to the right and growing and multiplying, and they tell everybody, well, every healthy thing does. And it has a ring of truth because it sounds like we're using God's general creation and general revelation to recognize how living things work. But the fact of the matter is, if we step back and look again, we'd realize, well, no, the only things that multiply forever are lowest things on the food chain. And nothing grows forever. It grows to fit its DNA, and then it stops. Might be an ant, might be a dog, might be an elephant. But once it's using all of its energy to sustain itself, the only way it grows bigger is with steroids. And we know those will kill you. And what I find in a lot of ministry settings, in particular, because of this myth of endless growth, is that when something has hit its size that God has really ordained for it, people start using, I call them ministry steroids. And then panic, just we got to find some way to get bigger and bigger. And it's like, well, no, the kingdom of God will continue to grow, but not every local manifestation of it.
So are there some ways that we can determine if we've reached our, I guess, quote-unquote, adult size?
Yeah, I'm asked that all the time. And my simple answer to that, and I hope it's profoundly simple, is you look and you ask, have we removed all the roadblocks to growth? And have we lit all the rockets to growth? So, for instance, the church has stopped growing completely, and it's completely out of parking space. Well, at some point, being out of any parking space or Sunday school classroom or whatever it would be, that obviously is a roadblock to growth. So have you added some more parking spaces? But once you add those or more classroom and it doesn't grow, okay, you've removed the barriers. Maybe this is it. And lighting rockets has to do with seizing opportunities that are there. So we spend a lot of time with our leadership team asking, what are the roadblocks we're facing? Are there any rockets we could light that would just make a huge difference? And often we find them, and we're still moving up and to the right. But the day will come when we've lit all the rockets, removed all the roadblocks, and this is where we are. And it's taking all of our energy to just sustain ourselves. And I go, at that point, let's celebrate what God has done. Let's not feel like we're losers because we stopped getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
But I suppose there is an aspect we have to admit that, you know, we can be ineffective as leaders too, right? So that, I mean, maybe we're the roadblock.
Yes, but, you know, to be honest with you, more often I run into, especially leaders who have a history of up and to the right growth, they'll get to 1,000, 2,000, really significant historical numbers. And they'll go, well, you know, maybe I'm not the guy to take it to the next level. I'm speaking of senior pastors here. And more often than not, when they leave, the next level is down, not up. And it's because in the American culture, we're so addicted to growth. It's as if we preach the body of Christ, but we don't believe it. Some things are big, some things are small. And there's niche ministries, there's mass ministries, there's all of these different things. And together, they're the church of our Lord Jesus.
That's good insight, Larry. Appreciate that. In a moment, I want to talk a little bit more about using the same recipe to innovate. And what happens if you get maybe your new ideas, new efforts get turned down regularly? You maybe lose your motivation to innovate. We'll get some good perspective from Larry Osborne, who's a pastor, author, and leadership consultant. And he's pastored one of the largest churches in Southern California, North Coast Church in Vista, California. You can find out more about him at northcoastchurch.com or larryosbornelive.com. And we'll talk more about his book, Innovation's Dirty Little Secret, coming up in just a moment. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. If you'd like to join our conversation, 877-933-2484.
Thanks for joining us for the best of Connecting Faith. More in just a moment.
Here's what's coming up on the next Faith Radio Mornings.
On Wednesday's Faith Radio Mornings, we'll be joined again by business and personal organization expert Bill English. He's going to continue sharing tips for helping us become more effective employees.
And then how do we get over being wounded by a loved one? At 7:40, we'll talk about how we get caught up in a flood of depression and doubt. But Dr. Richard Enright will join us and discuss his book called Forgiveness is a Choice.
Start your day with Faith Radio Mornings at 6 a.m. on Wednesday.
You don't have to thump a Bible in someone's face to be a witness for Jesus. In fact, most non-Christians are won over by simple acts of kindness. Next time on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll presents the simple key to becoming a winsome Christian witness. Be listening for the next broadcast of Insight for Living.
Mornings and evenings at 8:30 here on Faith 900 KTIS.
Welcome back to an encore presentation, the best of connecting faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired program.
46 past the hour, talking today with Larry Osborne about his latest book, Innovation's Dirty Little Secret. The subtitle is Why Serial Innovators Succeed Where Others Fail. It's published by Zondervan. Larry is a pastor and author and leadership consultant, widely recognized as for his innovations and insights, and does a lot of speaking, traveling, and many come to see the North Coast Church just to find out how they're doing church and learning from him and from their team. And Ryan, just thinking maybe we've reached our peak. Maybe this is the best we can do here on Connecting Faith.
It's why we're making the pilgrimage to Larry today.
Sure, we'll see if we can move up a little bit, maybe. I'm not sure. Larry, I'm interested to know, if we find a process that works. I mean, is this all about sort of getting into a process and we just keep using that recipe, or is every innovation a different way of approaching it?
Well, every innovation has its unique challenges and is certainly a different way of approaching, but there are those broader principles, such as if you oversell, you better have it spot on because you can't make mid-course corrections. And if it fails, you probably just lost your credibility. Try again. If you get too much input, it's going to be politically correct, but not work in the real world. So the principles of innovation are pretty universal. But every situation is absolutely unique.
If one of our listeners want to know, I mean, if you have attempted new ideas, new efforts, and they get shot down, you can kind of lose your motivation. What do you recommend? Do you have some encouragement to those who are still struggling to break out of some things?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing that I always say, understand innovation a little bit better, because a lot of times, which is why I wrote a book like Innovation's Dirty Little Secret, is when people read it, they go, oh, it's almost like somebody on the golf course saying, every time the hole is really long, I swing harder, but I hit a worse shot, because counterintuitively, you don't swing harder to hit the ball further. And so a lot of times people who've run into walls are doing some of the things that sound good, but actually hurt them. But other times I would tell somebody, you might be in an environment that is just completely unfriendly to innovation. They want to live in yesterday, or they're so afraid of risk, they won't take any chance, even on a trial or experiment basis. And at that point, you have to move on to be able to try the things you want to do. And that's just a fact of life. Not every environment is conducive to innovation.
Talking about some of the broad principles, talking with my son-in-law here the other day, we're talking about, working in pencil and the whiteboard, because it's sort of less formal and it feels okay. Again, it's sort of getting back to that trial run or experiment idea, I guess,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's two I call it planning in pencils, and there's two reasons. So when you use the language of let us try, people won't object. But the second thing is almost everything takes on a life of its own that's a little different than how it looked in a meeting or on paper. And so the more you have a rigid 3-year plan, all the steps in permanent ink, the harder it is to make mid-course corrections. I had some friends at JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab, and I thought these guys are absolutely genius. The mathematical calculations they figure to get a rocket to the moon, how in the world do you do that? And what I was surprised was that with all of their brilliance, they'd never get to the moon if they didn't make thousands of mid-course corrections every single day. They check reality with where they're aiming to get and alter. And when I heard that, I thought, my goodness, that is so true about real-life leadership as well. You have a plan, and then once it's out in the real world, it's always needing to be altered just a little bit.
Do you have some favorite innovators that you've sort of looked to, or maybe what's appealed to you about maybe some interesting innovations?
Well, I've always, one of the ways that I have gotten outside of me, my team, and my tribe that we talked about earlier is I've read business journals, because all my training is in theology. I was called into ministry right before my senior year of high school, started doing it when I was in college. So I have no business background except for the experiences and then consulting that came up later that I do. And so I've always been fascinated by companies that change the world at that point. More recently, you could look at Apple and Steve Jobs. You could go back to Microsoft and you could see the way that Bill Gates and some of those people thought. And they, all the principles that I kind of write about in this book, everywhere I look, I go, people who changed the world around them, all the way back to Edison, that's kind of how they did it. They experimented, had more failures than successes, trusted their own gut as a gifted innovator, but were always willing to change it once it got out in the real world.
Steve Jobs, I think you referenced that in terms of legacy. I mean, said, you know, don't be asking what would Steve do. I mean, that's probably part of our responsibility as a leader as well, isn't it? That we allow others to come behind us with their own good ideas.
Yeah, I believe the most important legacy I will leave at North Coast Church is the freedom for the next group of leaders to lead as God leads them, not to ask what did Larry do, because they don't know what Larry will do 30 years from now, because I won't be here, and I would probably respond 30 years from now differently than I did 10 years ago. It's well known that the Disney company almost went under asking what would Walt do for years and years and years until a guy named Michael Eisner showed up and said, I don't care what Walt would do. I don't know what Walt would do, but I know what we should do now. So legacy is allowing people freedom to think and be led of the Lord in Christian circles and ministry led of the Lord and scripture in the spirit, not restricted by the way we see the world.
In ministry, sometimes you run into, well, the Lord told me. That's always a little bit of a challenge, I guess, when you're trying to evaluate the wisdom of an idea.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of us are more mystical by personality, and we have the tendency to think that every thought we have is that we've really prayed about and thought about is the Lord told me. I always turn those folks back to Acts chapter 16, because I figure on the spiritual food chain, the Apostle Paul's pretty high, being an apostle and writing scripture. And he thought he was supposed to go to Asia Minor. He was wrong. Then he thought it was Bithynia. He was wrong. Then he thought it was Macedonia. And that worked out. But kind of, he got thrown in jail. So at the end of the day, I'm always trying to point out, even God's best don't always get his plan perfectly. It unfolds. It's like an old Polaroid picture. You start out seeing a little bit, but over time it gets clearer and clearer.
Talk a little bit about, we haven't talked about the mission statements, vision statements, how they're so vital and important. Let's say a word about that.
Well, mission statements, you know, people got along without them. So in one way, they're overblown. But in another sense, they're awesome if they're done well. If a mission statement is an honest articulation of what you truly care about and feel called to do, then you have something you can judge everything by. Is it advancing that cause that God has given us? Sadly, most mission statements aren't really honest. They're made by a committee, and everybody that has some politically correct idea throws that in. And so you get a long mission statement nobody can remember and is more a reflection of what we should be about than what we are about. And at that point, it's worthless. But if it's a clear articulation, like ours is making disciples in a healthy church environment, and then we have a measurement of disciples and a measurement of health, so we can always step back and at the one-year point or whatever, ask about every program and every initiative we do and say, is it producing disciples and is it killing our health as a church or is it sustaining our health as a church? And at that point, we can decide whether to do it or not. If your mission statement is fuzzy, all you worry about is if the crowds come. And we think it's success if people come, but it might not be advancing the cause at all. It might be just getting a lot of people to show up.
Do we kind of use the vision and mission, I guess, interchangeably sometimes, but we probably should make the distinction between them, right?
Yeah, mission is more what is the absolute goal, like for us making a disciple. And the vision is what that looks like. So it's more the storyboard, if you will, of how we get there. So our vision is a church with 80 to 90% of our weekend attendance in these sermon-based small groups, Electrolab model. I don't think every church that makes disciples has to do it that way, but that was our vision of what it would look like. And so your vision is the path. It's the description of what life is like when we actually are fulfilling our mission. And that's unique to every person and every group.
Do you look for younger leaders that you can mentor and sort of encourage them to innovate?
Absolutely. In fact, I think every organization has to have a place where the young eagles can fly, because if they can't fly in your cage, they're going to constantly leave and fly in another cage. And then you're going to be an old baby boomer still thinking you're young and hip. We need a both and. We need to honor the past and we need to create the future. But the only way to create the future is with people who are the future. So we work really hard in our environment to make sure we've got a lot of young leadership at the most important tables.
I'm sure this is a discussion that would be helpful to have maybe as a planning group at a business or maybe a church board or a leadership team or something, to have several reading and to just use it as to spark some conversation.
Absolutely. In fact, the whole book was written that way for the leader to think through, but it gives the opportunity to discuss these things, because it's amazing how much more honest and fluid a conversation will be when you're talking about a third party's idea, the thing in the book, rather than if you're a leader, you present the idea, because now it's, am I pushing back against you personally? It's much easier if the idea is over, kind of off to the side from a third party.
We still think you're young and hip and cool, Larry. Just want you to know. glad to have you on today, and really enjoyed the book and the discussion. And it'll be a great resource if you had the opportunity or didn't catch all the program today. You can always catch it on podcast. We post them after the show at myfaithradio.com. Larry Osborne, teaching pastor at North Coast Church. It's in Vista, California. North Coast has grown to 10,000-plus in weekend attendance, and Larry's written a number of books, and the one we've referenced today is Innovation's Dirty Little Secret. LarryOsborneLive.com, one of the ways that you could find out more about your writing. Larry, blessings to you. Thanks so much for taking some time today.
It's been a privilege being with you. Thank you so much.
Larry Osborne, joining us today on Connecting Faith. And again, you want to find out more, you can go to our website, myfaithradio.com, for the podcast.
This has been the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. To hear more engaging discussions on the intersection of faith and life, head to myfaithradio.com and click Connecting Faith.